You are now listening to the Spirits Distilled podcast presented by WSET, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. For more information on taking a WSET qualification, please visit our Where to Study page on our website, wsetglobal.com. We hope you will enjoy the program, and if you do, please take a moment to subscribe and rate Spirits Distilled on whatever podcast platform you are coming to us from. Welcome, listeners, to the Spirits Distilled podcast, presented by WSET, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. I'm Dave Rudman, and I'll be your host for this, episode number 4 of Spirits Distilled. As always, you can expect Spirits Distilled to bring you knowledge and diverse perspectives from WSET's experts, as well as from throughout the world of spirits. We've got a lot of information. We've got a lot of fun planned. Let's get right into it. In our main feature for this episode, we'll be adding some flavor to the conversation with a conversation about adding flavor. We have WSET Liam Scandrett, Business Development Manager Spirits, moderating a series of 3 interviews with 3 spirits experts, all about different methods and techniques used to add flavor to spirits. Liam's first guest is Matthew McGivern, founder of Rebel Distillers. Rebel Distillers is an award-winning spirit development agency specializing in the spirits and brewing industries and helping companies with product innovation, strategy, and upskilling of teams. Let's get things started by dropping into their conversation now.
I want to delve a little bit more into some of the apparatus at your disposal and dig a little bit deeper into some of the differences there. So what kind of equipment do you have at Rebel, and can you tell us a little bit more about the operation of the equipment and how you apply it?
Absolutely. So our kind of setup is we are more of a lab-based product. So we've got a small pot still, so copper pot still, and we've got a sort of a road of app, which is a vacuum still fundamentally. We also then have a lot of contracts with other distilleries around the country and now around Europe, which is fun. And then that gives us access to obviously bigger pot stills, to hybrid stills, to also column stills as well. And I think I mentioned to you on a separate conversation, Liam, about, you know, breweries getting into the whiskey industry. It's a good option for them to get rid of excess wash at this time. How we normally do is if we're working with a client, we will, and if it's fundamentally just around liquid development, we have a couple of options that we look at. I mean, we produce more than just gin. So, we have an absinthe, which is going to be coming out pretty soon. We also have an aperitif, which we've been working on, which is kind of a low sugar version, which we've had to go back to the drawing board a couple of times. But fundamentally, the setup that we have of a pot still and a road of app can cover those sort of product developments. So the pot still is, it's copper. You are heating, whether it's neutral spirit or a new make spirit. Obviously, for the setup that we have, it would have to come in at high ABV, so anything above 69%. And neutral spirit is sort of over 96%. And we are, macerating the botanicals in the spirit, and then usually leave it for 3 or 4 hours, depending on. I mean, it does make a difference actually, your maceration times, but sure. 3 or 4 hours for a small sort of 2 liter works quite well. And then we heat up the neutral spirit with the botanicals inside, so we don't use a vapor basket, and then you have, as the alcohol is coming through the top of the still, it's stripping out the essential oils. Sorry if I'm being really kind of
precisely the point, and it's interesting to hear about the specifics about how you're operating your pot still.
So once we're doing that there, then the top notes are coming off. So the more sort of volatile notes from the botanicals, and then you have almost a liquid journey as it becomes harder to get the alcohol through. So you might have liquid coming out in sort of 90% initially, and then it will drop down to about 60% where you start getting more vegetable notes. So these are the more heavier oils that are in your botanicals. And that's normally where we take a cut. So I'm usually a fan of creating cuttings at ABV levels versus necessarily taste. Obviously, taste is important, but I think it's, you know, when you have a big distillery with multiple distillers and it is down to personal taste, sometimes that note can, you know, I think vegetables are incredibly important to a product because they add so much complexity, but they can also spoil quite easily. So I mean, that's kind of how it is. I mean, I think the other thing I forgot to say was when we start the process, you have neutral spirit at say 96%, we would cut that down to 60%. Have the botanicals, and if you put it in too high an ABV, it will just shoot through the still too fast. It can cause damage to your still, and also the taste that you get is not great. So
sure. And that's fairly typical, right, to cut down to about 60%.
Yeah, totally.
And obviously if you were macerating in a neutral spirit, you'd also potentially draw out a lot of bitter and unwanted flavors from those botanicals during that maceration.
Absolutely. And I think as well, when you get into it, and this becomes the development over time. So the good thing about a little pot still is that you're getting flavor profiles, but you can kind of make decisions of maybe you macerate the juniper and maybe a cinnamon for longer than you would macerate the citrus, for instance. Yeah. You know, so and you might add things in at different times, and it's all about sort of doing the work and capturing the results. And I think over time you get to, you know, I'm not trying to say where we are, but obviously when you've made some good products, or actually when you made lots of bad products, because you always learn from the mistakes, you then just start to get a process and also a feel in terms of what you think will work in terms of flavor profile.
Sure. And I wanted to draw just another point on your maceration. You talked about just a 3 to 4 hour maceration in what is a fairly small still.
Yeah.
Is that because you've got this kind of greater surface area contact with the botanicals in that smaller space of a smaller volume of liquid, therefore kind of requiring a smaller length of maceration than you would see typically potentially at Boatyard, as we've spoke to Joe, who's doing 18 hours, I think, and Beef Eater, which do around 24 hours.
Absolutely. I mean, that is exactly the reason. I actually don't think it is a sort of straight line sort of curve in terms of when is the right time when you sort of volume up. So I agree. I don't think it's easy to say. For instance, if you're doing 2 hours for a 2 liter still, if you go up to a 200 liter still, it's then 20 hours. Do you know what I mean? There's a little bit more flexibility there. As a rule of thumb, I think it's not a bad way to start, though. Absolutely.
I want to speak a little bit more about your RotoVap and vacuum still. In my understanding, there's a vacuum pulled inside of that still, and I suppose a RotoVap, it's via these rotations, which enables boiling points of the various compounds inside to be lower, and therefore you can essentially distill at a lower temperature and obtain a different set of flavors entirely than you would in a normal atmospheric pressure still.
Absolutely. And it's about 20 degrees difference. So if you think the still is kind of more in the 60 to 70 degrees, this is the pot still, the RotoVap would be more like 40 to 50. So it is, you know, it's quite a big difference. And the flavors are incredibly different. And it's an amazing tool to work with more delicate botanicals, because I find the RotoVap is very much top notes that you're producing. And when I say top notes, it's kind of the on the nose, very front of the mouth feel, while the pot still has that more middle back of throat. So, you know, working them together, I feel you can create really fantastically well-rounded products. And I'm a huge fan of the RotoVap. I mean, if you think that there's some businesses that are just doing RotoVap, I mean, Empirical Spirits being one, and they do some amazing products. And they're very, I find them, and it's not being critical, I find them very kind of like instantaneously, like, wow, it's like so amazing in your face, and the front notes are so strong, but it's also very light. And, you know, that, to me, I think that's fantastic. But, you know, to have that and the back notes, I think you can make really lovely white spirits, you know. Absolutely. So,
I think you hit the nail on the head there. There's a kind of purity and real clarity of the notes and flavors in a vacuum produced spirit exclusively, because it's got this kind of, as you say, really bright, buoyant, front forward kind of flavor. I describe it as being generally quite pure and very, very clear, very well articulated and very well defined. But if you're a fan of some more warmth and some more textures that you might get from a pot still, then you need to combine the two techniques. And I just want to go back to some of those stills that you're looking to contractors for. So the hybrid stills that you mentioned, just for clarity, can you explain what a hybrid still is for the listeners?
Well, the hybrid still that we've been using and there's similar out there is that you'll have a pot still and then you will have something called a vapor trap. And the vapor trap is like a mini version of a column still. So you have plates, and the plates are normally in the hybrid stills is about maybe 10 to 15. And the plates are used to distill the spirit through, and you're almost doing lots and lots of mini pot stills. So what you're doing is you're taking and the hybrid stills are good for a wash, for instance, you are sort of removing the alcohol from the wash, so you're getting a higher ABV. So we've done a rye wash through a 15 plate hybrid pot still. I think we did it two runs, so it sort of went through the pot still, went through the vapor trap twice, and we got it to about 67%, and that was what we class as a new make spirit. So and it worked very well for rye in particular.
And many of these hybrid stills are versatile in the sense that you can use it simply as a pot and bypass those plates, and some of them even have removable plates and options to open up certain plates and change the amount of plates that runs through.
Absolutely, they're great tools. They're particularly expensive. That would be the only thing. So it's good to have some sales and some clients lined up to before investing in one, because I think nothing. I mean, as I said before, but we the people that we kind of do a bit of work with, they have capacity, and you've got an amazing asset. It's like a you know, an old time sports car. You know, you have to use it sometimes. If it sits there for months and months and doesn't get used, then you'll end up having more problems. And the hybrid stills in particular are quite fashionable a few years ago, and there's a few of them kicking around. And as you said, Liam, that you've got to use it, you know, or they become a bit rusty, and especially the vapor trap sections, they're quite challenging to work with at times. But yeah, really fantastic tool to use, absolutely.
You made some interesting points about cuts before as well, and kind of overdevelopment of some of those flavors, some of the stewed and kind of vegetal rooty notes that can come off at the end of a run, particularly with gin. Do you ever, or have you ever heard of people cutting in and out and taking different sections from a distillation run and then blending those? Or is it you know, a head's cut and a tail's cut only to take the hop?
No, I've definitely heard of it. I haven't really partaken in it, I must admit. I normally would do the heads and tails. Sometimes you would, once you're getting to the tails side, take cuts that you then decide to blend in. So you may be taking leader cuts, for instance. Right. And then that gives you a little bit of control, as you mentioned, about the stew notes towards the end. In particular, that would be if you're making it from a wash, I would find. I think it's a bit more cut and dry if you've got the same still you're making from a new make. If you're making a whiskey or a bourbon, because I know a lot of people in the bourbon industry do that. So they will separate the spirits from the heads quite far, and then they will almost. I'm trying to think who I remember seeing do this, but they. Oh, it's going to kill me who this was actually, but they. They seem to take 10 liter cuts, and then they would mark them up and catalog them. And then they would add, say, the first five, and then they would add a bit of 15, do a taste trial. And then, do you know what I mean? And then that was a very interesting way of doing it. it has a feeling more of that kind of individual sort of moonshine bourbon whiskey distiller feel about it, I think, to do
almost
that.
Almost the mezcal approach as well.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, I must have got very little experience in mezcal, but yeah, I've heard similar things. And I've only recently sort of discovered mezcal in terms of some of the good stuff, and it's absolutely fantastic liquid. It is.
Incredible use of what we consider heads and tails in you know, Scottish parlance. You know, the pushing with the boundaries of what's acceptable or what's considered as a fault. In more traditional or Western distilling techniques.
I think that goes back to these regulations as well. You know, they're so important because you can poison someone quite easily. I mean, I always like think of the cherry stone. You know, you can't distill cherry stone because you make a version of cyanide. Uh-huh. So, you know, you don't do that. But in reality, yeah. I agree. Well, you know, with all this lockdown, a couple of arguments going on in the house, so I'll keep the cherries away from my wife, definitely. But I mean, I think the regulations in reality actually do hold back a little bit of the flavor development, and I know mezcal is certainly a bit more loose when you compare it to tequila when it comes to that.
I spent a week in Japan in January to visit Okinawa, Amami, and Kagoshima, and Kumamoto, wow, and Miyazaki prefectures, to take a deep dive into Honkaku Shochu, Awamori, which certainly in Kagoshima with Satsuma Shochu and Miyazaki, where they're using sweet potato and barley as well. There's a great deal of what we consider heads being used in those spirits. In fact, they don't often make a head's cut. They will take the whole lot.
Wow.
Which is just, yeah, lots and lots and lots of flavor in there, lots of higher alcohols that can contribute to esterification as they're being rested in enamel or clay vessels. And also, so certainly from sweet potatoes, so many of those terpenes that you'd associate with rose and lychee and big floral flavors. Yeah, if you're looking for an area to expand into a rebel, I'd certainly recommend you testing the water with some shochu.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I'm definitely keen to get some of those contacts. Absolutely.
I've got you know how the Japanese love a business card. I collected thousands when I was there.
It's just like a clean handshake, and you just realize you've got a business card in your hand.
I took 100 with me, and I ran out on day 3. So that gives you an indication. Later in this episode, I'm talking to a flavor architect, which I mentioned. He creates flavors for beverage brands. I wondered if you have any experience using some purchase flavorings and compounding them into spirits, and if it's something you can give some insight into how cold compounding is done.
Yeah, so a little bit. I'm kind of going to stutter around this here. I find the flavorings that you buy in, natural or otherwise, they're so punchy when you add them into simply when we've created a gin in an IBC, so you know, 1,000-liter container, and you add minimal amount of the flavoring, it just completely takes over the whole product. So it's a real balancing act in terms of getting the dosage right. I think the way I've done it is as simple as the product has been produced and we have a clear dosage that's then added. It's then mixed with a paddle, sometimes a rowing paddle, and then left. And then it's tasted sort of 4 or 5 hours later and whether we're happy with it. And that is as dodgy a process as I've done with flavorings. But what I found with flavorings is that they take over the product. I feel like I can almost taste them, mm-hmm, rather than the pure process when mm-hmm we're sort of making it from a still. I know there's similarities, but a lot of times they'll use a solvent to make it, and it is different. But on the flip side, I do think the general public are used to flavorings, and I think actually a lot of I think of pink gins, and there's a lot of flavors in the pink gins. Yeah. And I remember hearing that Gardens Pink was outselling Gardens at one point, and it just like blew my brain. It did. So you know, I think it's something that everyone should be looking at, because it gives you consistency, and certainly the British consumer is used to drinking flavored spirits.
Cool. All right, well, I've just spotted the time. You know, it's an interesting chat when you lose track of time. So thanks, man. It's been a pleasure.
It's lovely speaking to you.
Thanks, Matthew, for sitting down with Liam and for sharing your knowledge and wisdom with our listeners. Before we get to the next of our three conversations this episode, we've got a feature called Desert Island Drinks, where we answer the drinks world's most famous small talk question. If you were stranded on a desert island and could have only one drink, what would it be? Here at Spirits Distilled, we've put a slight spin on the question and are inquiring of our guests, what is your one sipping spirit, your one mixing spirit, and your one guilty pleasure drink? In this edition of Desert Island Drinks, we pose the question to Natsuki Kikuya. Natsuki has worked as a sake sommelier at Zuma and Rocco Restaurant in London, and in 2013 launched her sake education and PR agency, Museum of Sake, which promotes sake in European markets. She is a WSET certified sake educator, teaching at the WSET School in London, and she helped to develop WSET's Level 3 Award in Sake that launched in 2014. Here's what she had to say.
My name is Natsuki Kikuya, director of Museum of Sake. If I am stranded on a desert island, one drink I would happily drink would be my favorite sake, called Jikon from Mie Prefecture. It has a beautiful aroma and fragrance of cantaloupe melon and nectarines and apricot. And then I can happily drink that chilled or have a cube of ice inside. The way to mix them is I follow my friend Maria Chiba's recipe to drop a few cubes of frozen black coffee. So as the time goes by, the frozen coffee melts slowly in the sake. It makes wonderful harmony together. I highly recommend you to do it. And my favorite guilty pleasure drink is another Japanese liqueur called umeshu. It's based on the Japanese ume, apricot, or plum, and has a super juicy, sweet flavors inside. My favorite way to drink it is to mix with soda or tonic water.
I definitely took notes during that one. There's a lot I have to learn about sake, and what better way to do it than to taste on the recommendation of an expert. Thanks, Natsuki. We'll be hearing more from you later in this episode. But right now, let's continue with our main feature and the second of three interviews moderated by WSET's Liam Scandrett. Liam's guest this interview is Joe McGurr. Joe has worked in the spirits industry since 2004, and in 2013 had the opportunity to set up his own dream distillery in Ireland, the Boatyard Distillery, where Joe and his team strive for perfection in each of their spirits. Let's drop into their conversation right now.
So throughout this series, we've spoken to a host of spirits producers and focused on particular stages of spirits production through fermentation, distillation, and maturation. However, in this episode, we're focusing on post-distillation and the addition of flavor through means other than maturation in oak, namely redistillation, maceration, and compounding. Now, the starting point for the majority of flavoured spirits, certainly gin distillers, is a base neutral spirit. Whereas producers of whiskey or brandy are like sculptors crafting their spirit from the base material, gin producers tend to be more like painters taking a blank canvas spirit and marking that spirit with a palette of botanicals and techniques for adding flavour. Now, the reason I've been so excited to be speaking to Joe on this first episode is that Boatyard make a frankly incredible neutral spirit from scratch. So I thought we'd start by talking about the production of your neutral spirit and your vodka and how you particularly go about it there.
Yeah, so when I came across from the whiskey world and came into gin and realized that gin has this compounding and that this redistillation element, but I wanted to really focus on the brewing and fermentation side. I grew up through the whiskey world, where that is the starting point. So gin, obviously made from this neutral spirit, we spent some time developing, well, how could we make a vodka? So our starting point was not the gin. In fact, it was really about, well, how do we put in the mechanics to make a vodka? So we buy in wheat from four different farmers, and we will get it malted So it's malted wheat with mint, with the guys at Minch Malt. And then it comes up to Boatyard in Fermanagh. Unfortunately, Fermanagh, we're in the northwest. The weather is just not great for growing wheat, and you can't get the moisture content down low enough. We will mash at around about 71 degrees, leave that for 90 minutes or so, maybe a little bit longer, and then drain it off. Standard brewing process, really. We crash cool it to around about 24 degrees. And then I guess the crucial thing for us is we use a champagne yeast, and that's very important and part of our story. We're a small distillery, so that we have lots of inefficiencies, and I knew from the start, mainly through budget, that, you know, we were never going to have this crazy efficient plant. It was all about making the most of the ingredients that we had. And so we're using a champagne yeast, which really is inefficient, and it's got a lot of flaws, and you wouldn't traditionally use it for this type of spirit, especially not for a vodka. But the thing for me is I didn't want to use any additional enzymes or anything to boost the alcohol content.
So the malted wheat has sufficient enzymatic properties to do that conversion of carbohydrate into fermentable sugars?
That's right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So we get enough from that. And we're using about 125 kilos per mash, so quite a small mash. And we're using, so then we crash cool, add champagne yeast, and we are using that to ferment out for about eight to nine days, really.
Which, as you say, is not very traditional when it comes to vodka production or neutral spirit production or any kind of light mark production in rum either. Right. You know, we're talking about very efficient yeast strains, hot and hard fermentations to create as much ethanol as possible and as little flavor as possible. But you're saying the champagne yeast is obviously counter to that tradition.
I mean, my argument is that yes, you want to convert as much to alcohol as possible, but what you don't convert carries flavor. So that water, the properties that are in there, carries a huge amount of flavor that's left. So yes, it is very labor intensive for the tiny minuscule amount that we get out. But it's, you know, we feel it adds to the properties of the final spirit. We get this amazing banana note that comes from our spirit. And it's got this beautiful kind of texture as well that I would blame on that yeast.
Isobutyl acetate, I would expect, as we discovered in the fermentation episode, speaking to Shane McNamara and Maggie Campbell, it was a point of discussion, that banana flavour, that isobutyl acetate, sometimes kind of bubblegum banana, kind of foam banana quality you get in certain spirits. And as you say, directly related back to the yeast.
Yeah, so then we take our wash, we distill it the first time to around about 32%, and then we go second time to 75%, and then the third and final run we do to 96%, and we've got a small hybrid still that drips the liquid out. It is incredibly painfully slow to produce on that final run. And it's a form of rectification, very, very slow rectification on an ice still.
So this is Dr. Fusion, as you call it.
Mr. Fusion.
Fusion. Sorry, I've elevated his status now. And those three runs are all through the same hybrid still?
They are at the minute. We've actually got two of the hybrid stills. We've got a 250-litre and a 500-litre. But we're using the 500 liter for efficiencies. But we think it's worth it. You know, it's a spirit that bartenders and real spirits fanatics absolutely love and get really into, and can see the effort.
It's definitely what we describe at the WSET as a characterful vodka, not a typical neutral vodka, something that retains lots of flavor, as you say, from the raw material, and then also some flavor generated by your yeast in that long fermentation.
Our argument would be that not all neutral spirit is the same. So obviously when you go as a distiller making gin, you can order Nutrospirit from lots of different sources. But if you look at the small print, you know, it's traditionally mixed grain because that would be the cheapest, or maybe not even not a non-agricultural source. But so there's a lot of different grades of Nutrospirit. So that leads us on to the gin side. Yes. And we're using 100% wheat, and it's organic wheat for us as well, that we use for the gin. We simply can't produce enough Nutrospirit for our own gin. And also the rectification process, it's not about just having the number of plates. You don't just need a 40-foot column to produce good Nutrospirit. You need hydro selection and separation. So it's a completely different world. At the end of the day, it's the biggest part of your gin bottle, effectively. So you need that canvas to be right, as you call it. It has to be the right starting point to work from.
And why is that so important for a gin producer? What is it about the Nutrospirit that kind of lays the foundations for flavour additions?
I think it adds, I feel it adds to texture and sweetness are the two biggest things that the consumer might notice when you try the product. And you add that, you know, there's a certain thin, that viscosity on the tongue. I would feel, having trialed a few of these different, go from one extreme, from the cheapest to the 100% wheat, which is more hard to come by. You definitely notice the difference, for sure.
So moving on to your gin then, I believe you use 8 botanicals in your classic double gin. Can you tell us a bit more about the selection and the sourcing of those botanicals? You know, I don't suppose you have a botanical sales rep knocking on the door. You have to go to them, do you?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing was, I'm not a botanist. So right early on, I wanted to bring in that level of experience and really get it right from the start and understand why we're using certain things and what flavor combinations, and maybe wanted that bit of a sounding board. So I brought in a lady called Suzanne Masters, who was a botanist at Kew Gardens. She's helped out with a few distilleries, Isle of Harris and a few others. So we spent a few days going around on bikes in Fermanagh, looking at the flora and fauna of different elements and different botanicals that you could use in your gin, some legal, some not so legal. And that we found and documented, but it was all about seeing things that would work. The core of what I wanted to do though was to have a juniper heavy and really to be a juniper dominant flavor profile, and that's really what I was looking for in our gin, to be a traditional without gimmick, should I say. I know some people don't like that word, but it was, had to be juniper at the start. Everything else kind of singing at the same tune, and all about balance. So we didn't want something that was over saturated or too overspiced in one particular direction. We find this one ingredient called sweet gale, which grows on my dad's farm. It's otherwise known as bog myrtle as well. So there's a few other distilleries use it in their product. We're using fresh. So we get harvest this about 3 or 4 times per year and use this as part of a recipe. Only in very, very small amounts. So sweet gale would have been used in 11th century brewing. And then by 12th, 13th century, it was a poor man's additive. And then it was never really seen again.
So as a kind of hop substitute flavouring agent in brews? Right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, pretty much. And it's got this beautiful eucalyptus almost tea aromatic, but it really adds something, I think, for me. We didn't want it to be the dominant flavor, so it was, again, coming back to the juniper. We did look at we looked at juniper from Ireland as well, but really the quality isn't there, and a lot of it's poisonous. There's many different types of juniper, so the stuff that we found and used couldn't use. So we wanted consistent supply. The problem we had right at the start was we're a small company, and we're still a small company, and we have to fight to get quality juniper. And for that, as the dominant flavor, it's one of the hardest things I found, because you're basically left as a new distillery with all of the stuff at the bottom, we're not Bombay Sapphire or Tanqueray. We don't have them contracts sewn up. And that led me on to the organic side and trying to... the organic juniper was the only way that I could guarantee, I found from the tests that we've done, to get that quality level. And at least, yeah, you're paying an extra bit and you know that you're going to hit that quality mark on the distillation. You know, the stuff that we're sourcing is from Arezzo in Tuscany. And we're using that as part of our ingredient makeup. So it was all about getting as much juniper in there as possible. And probably the main reason is that's what I like to drink, and that's where it was founded on. So we're using the organic juniper. We use coriander in there as well. We're using three different roots. We're using licorice for the sweetness. We're using angelica. Obviously, a lot of gin distilleries use that as a binding agent, and we're using orris for that perfume note in there as well, just to add a little bit of lift on the finish.
You make an Old Tom as well. Is the licorice proportion in that recipe just increased in that Old Tom, or?
It's the same, actually, because I found on the trials we've done, the more licorice you add in there, it makes it hot. It's very, very kind of a hot, spicy. And yes, you do get a bit of this natural sweetness, but it was making it too imbalanced for me.
Right.
And it's one of the challenges that we face today, even still, because we made a commitment not to add glycerin or sweeteners in any of the products and any of the gins, the Old Tom. So it was one of the challenges we had, was how do we sweeten this without adding in sugar, you know, or a chemical.
And you use honey to do that then?
So for the Old Tom, we used honey. We started batch one, we used honey, and we had a little bit of separation issue, part of our own learning process in that. I'm not afraid to say it was a mistake. We probably put in too much and then had some separation. So we tried to adapt on that. We've toned back the honey a little bit, and we're now using Pedro Jimenez sherry barrels. So first fill, Pedro Jimenez sherry barrels from a little bodega just outside Jerez, and we're using from this place, and that adds that raisin, that treacly sweetness, and is a substitute really. But yeah, and then within the gin we use a citrus element, so we're using some unwaxed lemon peel, and we're also adding in some grapefruit peel, a small amount of grapefruit peel in there as well. I look for a fruit pastille note within the gin, and that's, it comes right at the start of the run. And if you don't have that, then there's something wrong. Maybe the fruit is not the same, or there's an imbalance in one of the ingredients. And then it comes, so the production technique that we've got, we use all of our botanicals are macerated for 18 hours. It's probably quick maceration. I know some people do different number of days or don't macerate at all, but we wanted to prime the spirit and really get it started for the run for the next day. And then it goes into our 300 liter Karl, our German copper alembic still, which I have designed for bespoke for us. And the Karl, the German engineers have fixed my design problems and made it work. so they put it together.
Written on the back of a fag packet, was it?
It pretty much was. It was scribbled out on some paper multiple times, in fact. And then they said, well, no, you can't do that. You have to do this. And I wanted, the flavor profile I was going for was bags of juniper, but then this light sort of more delicate and balanced finish on the spirit. And that's why we put in the column. So we've got a column next to the alembic with five plates in there. But then the five plates, traditionally people would put in a vapor basket, maybe either in the still or in between the column and the alembic. We've chosen to put the vapor basket right at the end of the process. Right at the end of the distillation process. And that has given us, it's really given us extra juniper hit. So we're packing in the botanical basket with juniper, but we almost create a, if this sounds very dangerous, but we almost create a blockage in the chamber, which is forcing the vapor up through the juniper. So it's physically forced through it. And that is picking up more oils and more juniper oil right at the start.
So it's a high intensity vapor extraction as opposed to how we traditionally think of using a vapor basket like that and you're producing a lighter style. You think it's actually contributing to some of that juniper hit in this case?
I think so, yeah. And that's where the double gin element comes out of, because we've got juniper in the pot in malt distillation and then right at the end of the process. And then maybe one of the key parts to our gin is that we the heads cut we leave in. So people talk about heads, hearts and tails. We will extract the end of the last run, the last distillate. Obviously, we get rid of that. But we keep the heads in there because there is, I find, I don't know if you've ever had the experience to try the heads of a gin spirit, but it's got so much intense oil in there. And the amount of flavor that you get in 200 mils is incredible. It is unreal. If I could just bottle that, I would.
And you don't need to worry about any nasty higher alcohols in high proportion because you're using a clean, neutral spirit that's been demethylized anyway, right?
So it's demethylized. So there's no need to discard that heads if you don't need to. There's no risk. But the flavor and intensity is off the scale for that first part.
And is it primarily citrus up there in that early part of the run?
It's mostly citrus. I'm looking for that fruit pastille note coming through and that fruit note. And then we start into that more, that spicier side and a little bit of the aromatic from the sweet gale in there as well from my dad's bog. And then you go down into the chocolatier, that more chocolate spicy dark fruit root. And then at the end of the run, obviously, all of that loveliness turns to things like wet dog, baby sick, boiled milk, things that you just do not want in there. Okay, thanks, Liam.
Thanks, Joe. See you next time.
Thanks for your time. All right. Thank you,
Nate. All the best.
Great conversation. Thanks, Joe, for sharing your knowledge and wisdom with Spirits Distilled. Before we move to the final of three conversations about adding flavor, we have another feature that we like to do. It's called Letter to My Younger Self, where we ask some of the spirits world's most experienced and successful players to let us know what advice they would give themselves when they were first getting started on their journey. In this edition, we're back with our friend Natsuki Kikuya, director of Museum of Sake, to hear her advice to her younger self.
Dear Natsuki, there are a few things that you might like to know. What to definitely embrace is all the dots in your life, whether that might feel useless at time or doesn't mean anything, actually comes all together at the end. So even some of the things you wouldn't enjoy, some of the things you suffer, all comes to the spice of your life. So please enjoy that. What to definitely avoid is to not be square. So judging things, deciding things, not listening to other people too early would give you all the non-benefit. So try to see the whole world from different angles. The great moments of joy that you will have later in your journey, probably you might not be drinking at this moment, but your mom's family roots of sake brewing, thanks to your very precious, loving grandfather, you will find the joy, your career, your professions, and your love in sake.
Wow, Natsuki, that is some inspired and inspiring advice. Thank you so much for sharing it with us here at Spirits Distilled. It's now time to move on to the third of Liam's conversations about adding flavor. And his guest is Siobhan Feely, distiller and distillery coordinator with Sacred Spirits, an award-winning vacuum distillery in Highgate, London. Prior to working for Sacred Spirits, Siobhan managed the Oliver Conquest, a pub specializing in gin, with a collection grown from 15 bottles in 2014 to now over 400. I can't wait to hear what Siobhan has to say.
I haven't spoken to any other vermouth producers on this episode, so I do want to get your take on that. And you said at the start that the amber specifically was one of your babies. So tell us a little bit more about A, the base wine, and B, how you're adding flavor to that base wine through macerations, distillates, and sugar I'd like to get onto as well.
Yeah, so as I said, we have three variants of vermouth, so covering all of the kind of most of the styles of vermouth. I'll start with the dry. So we initially made all of the vermouth in conjunction with Duke's Hotel because the head bartender Alessandro wanted a vermouth that he could throw on the floor, part of the show of going to there. So we started with the dry and not adding any sugar, which is very unusual in like a Bianco dry, extra dry style. There's always going to be a little sprinkling of sugar because most people would find it unpalatable because of its dry intensity, but we stuck with it. So it's got no sugar in it. We have things like a macerated savoury and thyme and English wine. The wine is from Gloucestershire, from a Three Choirs vineyard.
And is there any residual sugar in the wine, therefore, to help with that lack of or no need for sugar?
No, not really. Not a lot. If you tasted the dry, you'd kind of realise there's not a lot of residual sugar. So,
what variety, do you know?
Moulin, Phoenix, and I can't remember the third one. I always forget the third one. But, it's a cross blend, and they kind of just ship us the wine and we play around with it, basically. So we've been working with them since we've started to make the vermouth. It's a great little vineyard. They have two vineyards, which are amazing. So we also have the amber, which I don't know if anyone knows about the history of martinis or the Vespa, but the Vespa was invented by Ian Fleming in Duke's Hotel. So he wrote James Bond and invented the Vespa martini in it, which was gin, vodka and Quina Lillet, which I don't know if anyone knows about Quina Lillet, but there's only six bottles left in the world. Ian has two of them. There's one in, so Ian has two. One he's opened, one he has. Oh, no, I think he's got three. He definitely said three the other, anyway.
Got three of the six in the world.
Yeah.
I hope they're all in separate places.
They're all under lock and key. I will not go near any of them. I refuse to touch the bottles because they are like a piece of history.
You know this is going out globally, don't you?
Huh?
You know this podcast is going out globally, don't you?
Oh, yeah. They're hidden in lock and key, secret passcodes. You don't know anything about it. They're in safe boxes. But Ian opened one because he wanted to replicate Quina Lillet, which he got very close with the amber. So that's kind of the style. It's very orangey. We use a lot of orange through it. It's light, fresh. It's got a little bit of bitterness to it, but not too much. So we do approach kind of like the spritz market with it as well. But it's just delicious, 21.8%. And then we have our spicy mousse, which is, as I said, a Rosso style. So lots of spice through it, like things like allspice and star anise and nutmeg. And it's just delicious and complex and great for cocktails, basically.
You'd think that the higher alcohol content would also negate the need for sugar, because alcohol and sugar are both carriers of flavour, right? And provide a liquid with texture.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So if you've got more alcohol, you've got less need for sugar. So if that's an aspiration as well, then that kind of marries up quite nicely.
Yeah, we try to, where we can, try to avoid adding too much sugar to anything. So the products that have sugar in it are the Rosehip Cup, the two vermouths, English spiced and the amber vermouth, and then our Old Tom gin, because obviously Old Tom is a sweeter style of gin, but there's not, and our soju gin, sorry, but there's not a lot of sugar in anything really.
I think there's misunderstanding amongst the trade about sugar generally, and on this particular episode I've debated sugar with a couple of guests, and obviously it's a hot topic in rum at the moment, which we probably haven't got time to go down that rabbit hole. But, you know, sugar is obviously a tool that producers can use within certain categories, including rum, but obviously vermouth and liqueurs and other such things as well. But I think there's misunderstanding amongst the trade about in what form that sugar comes and then how it's applied. So tell us about, you know, where your sugar comes from and kind of how you then blend it with the distillates and macerates.
So sugar's always added at the end, and we kind of add it little by little because you don't want to oversweeten it. And we, once again, we try and stay organic. So we don't have one source of sugar. We try to use, you know, something that isn't Tate and Lyle. So we, at the moment for our Old Tom, we have organic Brazilian sugar in there. And that's added at the end. So you'll blend all the distillates into jerry cans, very unromantic again, and then add the right amount of sugar. Because there's nothing worse than ruining a lot of money's worth of distillate with something that's too sweet. So there is, once again, there's variance on things like colour with the Old Tom. You know, some of our sugar will have a slight hue to it. So you'll get one bottle of Old Tom and it will be clearer than another one. So there's variance on the sugar, just that, as you said, seasonally, it kind of changes a bit, but batch to batch. But yeah.
Is it white sugar? Yeah.
Yes.
Granulated sugar?
Yes.
They're pretty much flavourless. It's just adding a sweetness.
Yeah, and it is needed with some of the products. But without it, it wouldn't be the world's best vermouth. It would be the world's best Old Tom. It needs that sweetness to kind of lift the botanicals almost, especially things like orange peel, orange sugar, kind of like candied orange is always a winner with customers, basically. So.
Well, the one botanical we haven't mentioned is wormwood, right? And
yes,
labeled a vermouth, it must have wormwood in it, and wormwood is very bitter. It's a bitter ingredient.
Wormwood is very bitter. We've had so much wormwood macerated over the years that in my 3 years I've never handled it too much apart from one batch, but it's very bitter and you need the sweetness to kind of come away from that, because a lot of people's palates aren't accustomed to that type of bitterness. I don't know whether it was from caveman times when it was teaching you not to eat certain things, but yeah, bitter is a hard thing for people to grasp. So the sugar kind of helps with that bitterness. Although I do love wormwood, and Ian does this weird thing where he'll redistill the dregs of it, and it's extra bitter, and it gets bitter and bitter and bitter, which I've tried, and it was horrendous. So, but yeah, so it just helps the palate, really, for people who aren't, you know, Negroni inclined or Campari aficionados.
That would be interesting to learn more about, actually, that bitterness and which particular compounds within wormwood and then the distiller are responsible for that, because tannins are too big to actually carry over distillation. So that's something we often associate with bitterness in wine.
Yeah.
So it'd be interesting to know what compounds in the distiller are providing that bitterness still as it moves through.
Yeah, 100%.
In terms of your macerates, are they all individual as well? So you're not macerating anything together? So the wormwood macerate is in and of itself?
Everything is separate. So it's not great for space, but it's just better for us because you don't want one thing ruining the other thing, basically. And other different maceration times. So you would, with like coriander seeds, you don't have to soak it as long as you would wormwood, gentian root, stuff like that, just because the spirit isn't, it's penetrating the botanical quicker and slower. So to separate it is much easier to handle.
And in those vermouths, that wormwood macerate and the other ones, are they're only macerates going into the blend or
yeah. So only macerated, so that's where the bitterness comes from in our vermouth, is the macerated wormwood and gentian.
Sure.
We have distilled it before just as an experiment.
Yeah.
But obviously it comes out fresher, lighter, The bitterness is a little bit there, but obviously, as you said, bitterness doesn't still. So it'd be interesting to find out where it comes from.
Mm-hmm. And they're fortified using your GNS?
Yeah. So we use mostly organic wheat spirit that we get from England. I can't say where, but we get it from England. We try to keep everything as English as possible where we can, but, you know, not a lot of ginger grows here and stuff like that, so we'll have to source that away. But, yeah, all macerated in 60 or 70% wheat spirit, which gives it a kind of creamy mouthfeel that's just delicious.
So when it comes to producing a new batch of amber, let's say, it's a case of following a recipe.
Yeah.
And basically picking from your palette of macerates, taking the base wine and blending that with the sugar and your neutral grain spirit and then resting for some time? Or is it a case of bottling straight away?
Bottling straight away. So we blend everything into jerry cans apart from the wine. So the wine gets added at, we have a bottling plant. So the wine gets added at the bottling plant. But yeah, we blend everything to a specific recipe, which is on a Excel sheet in a locked file that no one can access apart from me and Ian. So it's quite useful in that sense, where you can type in the amount of litres that you want and it will change the recipe for you. And you just blend it into jerry cans and send it off to the bottling plant. And yeah, it's funny you should say about amber, because I'm actually doing that this week. So
my favourite one.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'm very excited to show you the new bottles.
As I say, I really, really look forward to a visit when we're able. I know there's lots of others at the WSE too. It'd be very, very keen to come down and see these stills as well. So yeah. But let's stay in touch. That'd be great.
Yeah, 100%. We'll have the sales team are great, and they'll bring all hospitality down and show you the distillery and how we do things. And hopefully you can catch Ian, and he can talk to you more about the chemistry side.
About that bitterness.
About that bitterness. I'm sure he has an answer.
Folks, if you don't know it by now, it's all about the flavor. Thank you to Liam, and special thanks to all three of his guests, Matthew McGivern, Joe McGurr, Siobhan Feely, and to Natsuki Kukuya. Keep up the great work out there in the drinks world. Well, that's all for episode 4 of Spirits Distilled. I hope you enjoyed the program. We hope you'll join us again next time for another fantastic episode. Until then, I'm Dave Rodman saying cheers from WSET. Thanks for listening to the Spirits Distilled podcast presented by WSET, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust. Please remember that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WSET. If you enjoyed this program, please take a moment to subscribe and rate Spirits Distilled on whatever podcast platform you are coming to us from. For more information on taking a WSET qualification, please visit our Where to Study page on our website, wsetglobal.com.